Welcome to Another News, I'm Jeff Brady. Today we're going to revisit the work and research of Dr. Judy Wood, the author of one of the most important books available to read titled Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. In past shows with Dr. Wood as a guest, we discussed in depth how her book didn't speculate or theorize. Instead, it provides verifiable evidence, answering the question, where did the towers go, and much more. In later shows, we had conversations about how, despite having the video of the towers coming apart in the air broadcast into TV screens across the planet repeated for many days, no one really knew what they were looking at. National TV commentators were understandably at a loss for words, but had real difficulty in accurately describing that the two towers turned to dust in the air. You may ask, what has happened to our ability to problem solve or our skill to critically analyze a situation? In this show, we'll get into some of the reasons of how and why our critical thinking skills have atrophied and what we can do to improve them. Returning guest Dr. Judy Wood is a former professor of mechanical engineering with research interests in experimental stress analysis, structural mechanics, optical methods, deformation analysis, and the materials characterization of biomaterials and composite materials. Dr. Wood, welcome back to Another News.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
In the past 30 years or so, critical thinking and problem-solving skills of people have atrophied. There are a number of areas to look at as reasons why this may be. As a teacher of physics, you've been very familiar with the learning process and also the shortcuts that some students take to get the right answer. Cumulatively, taking shortcuts to circumvent the process of thinking something through has taken its toll on our ability to problem solve independently. We've allowed ourselves...
I can't agree with you more there.
We've allowed ourselves to be programmed with a process of groupthink in the hive mind. And you reference a quote from Professor Eric Larson about the scientific method. He runs the OliverArtsPress.com and is author of several books, including The Skull of York, The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Grave Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11. The scientific method, Eric Larson writes, as it came into being during the Enlightenment period, is a method of thought known as empiricism or as the empirical method. Under the terms of empiricism, all conclusions are, must, and can be drawn from observable evidence and from observable evidence only. Evidence must precede any and every conclusion to be drawn from it. Then, if sound logic governs in the relationship between evidence and the conclusion drawn from it, that conclusion will be irrefutable. Dr. Wood, the conclusion of Chapter 20 in your book, Where Did the Towers Go?, references the perils of playing the name the weapon game. Chapter 20, Conclusions. And you begin this segment with a quote from Vincent Bugliosi. We're talking about the fact that most people see what they expect to see, what they want to see, what they've been told to see, what conventional wisdom tells them to see, not what is right in front of them in its pristine condition. Empirical evidence is the truth that theory must mimic. I have repeated the statement several times in the book because its importance cannot be overemphasized. In today's culture of oversimplification and standardized multiple-choice testing, many have had an impulse to name a known technology, e.g. thermite, TNT, RDX, nukes, progressive collapse, HARP, scalar weapons, torsion physics, Nazi Bell, etc. Instead of looking at the evidence that the use of one technology or another has left behind. It's like someone trying to force a square peg into a round hole because no one they know has ever seen a square peg, much less given it a name. So the possibility of a square peg's existence is not considered, even as they struggle to force it into the round hole. Some people feel that they're being more scientific when they use the name of a known technology to describe unknown phenomena, but the opposite is true. Such an approach omits evidence that does not fit any known technology. For some people, the term HARP, or the term scalar weapons, or the term Nazi Bell, is used as a catch-all weapon that can be blamed for whatever evidence needs to be explained, like the ultimate boogeyman, and without their even knowing what these weapons can do. Furthermore, if the full capabilities are classified information, they would not be publicly known, and a weapon that can produce all of the effects we saw on 9/11 would certainly not be in the public domain, no matter whose weapon it was. For these reasons, I've tried to focus on the phenomena, not a trendy name of a particular technology. The evidence must come before the theory. It is understanding what the technology can do that matters, not the name of it. For these reasons, I've resisted the impulse to name a known technology, and instead have focused on the physical evidence. There will likely be those who will not be as successful in resisting the impulse to put a name of a known technology on the producer of this evidence. This naming, however, will only serve to pull a veil of mystery over it.
The significance of this is that when people start name-dropping trendy terms and, you know, play spin the dial on the name that weapon game, they're focusing on the name, not the evidence. The evidence tells all you need to know, no matter what you name it. I do have a name in this book on page, 365, I think?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the page, son. Yep, on the top. I kind of tuck it in there, but I don't want people, you know, name-dropping that either. But it describes what the evidence is, actually. Magnetic electrogravitic nuclear reactions.
Okay. From what I've discovered in preparing this book, an even more accurate term may be magnetic electrogravitic nuclear reactions.
It's just describing the evidence. The evidence tells you, you know, whatever the name of this black box gizmo does. And that is what is important. It's understanding what it can do, not who can name it first. You know, people memorize a list of... You there?
Yes.
I heard that beep.
Oh, you had a beep on your end. Okay.
Yeah, big one. It sounded like the phone cut off.
Okay.
That was another one.
I don't hear him. I can't hear him.
How about you reestablish the call? It was actually cutting out, like another call was cutting in.
It sounds good now. I didn't hear it.
Yep. So it was just the two. Okay. So where were we? The name, the weapon game.
Right.
And, you know, people memorize a list of talking points with a list of, you know, HARP, Nazi Bell, torsion, whatever their trendy term is, you know, scalar weapons. Yeah, we know what HARP is. It was HARP. I know it was HARP. See, I know what I'm talking about because I can drop it and, you know, do name dropping,
mm-hmm.
the trendy terms. But it doesn't mean they understand what they're saying. And everything, it seems, nowadays has to come down to just getting a name so you can check off whatever box on the test and you move on. It's not about understanding.
Does this relate to your observations in the classroom and what you've been seeing teaching students over the years?
Oh, very much. They actually learned how multiple choice tests are made, standardized multiple choice tests. I once gave a multiple choice test on the final exam, and you know, a portion of it, because I had turned in the grades 2 days later, and you know, needed to speed up the grading. But it was a very easy problem that almost everyone failed because they thought it was easier to guess, you know, in the regular pattern they're used to guessing in. What is the average stress of a 10-pound weight hanging on a rope that has a 1 square inch cross section? Well, it's just asking if you know how to determine average normal stress. And so it's 10 pounds per square inch. You know, 10-pound weight distributed over 1 square inch is 10 pounds per square inch. And I had, you know, like 5 different answers there. and you see them cross out the biggest number, cross out the smallest number, and flip a coin for something in between, or some other scenario they went through. But in my multiple choice tests, they're nothing but nothing close to standards. And if they played that game on the test, because my tests were unusual, they couldn't guess the answer. It wasn't the typical pattern, whatever that is, that they're used to outguessing on. And it would have been so much easier to just answer the questions that were given. They're very easy.
This particular question, because it was multiple choice, and you don't do that very often on your tests, it caught them off guard.
Right. They regress into how to psych out a multiple choice test.
Instead of going through the independent thinking process.
Right, instead of just thinking what the question's asking, what's the average normal stress? The average normal stress is force divided by area. Here's the force, 10 pounds. Here's the cross-section, 1 square inch. People are taught, you know, they get good at taking multiple choice tests because that is what is being tested. They're not tested as how well they can solve a problem.
After a while, what do you think happens to our problem-solving skills, Dr. Wood?
They go away. It becomes impulse action as to, you know, answering a question. An example I gave you earlier was, you know, you hear about a snake oil salesman, and that seems synonymous with fraud. Well, it became that because, you know, this true snake oil that was being sold was actually good. From a Chinese or Japanese source, had high omega-3 oils in it, and was actually did cure people. But a false, fraudulent copy of it was made from rattlesnakes. So it didn't have the same curing effect, so it became known as a fraudulent remedy. So people hear snake oil or snake oil salesman, that's become a pejorative term for, you know, somebody selling nonsense. And there's a lot of things that happen like that. People get a certain meaning, and it's just impulse. It's like they've learned from flashcards. Because there was first, you know, testimony about how good it was, and then people made fraudulent copies of it. You know, they made it out of rattlesnake oil, and then it didn't do anything. But they had these people still trying to sell it. It was a cheap version of what the real product was. And so people learn from that, okay, it's bogus.
My question is, what do you attribute this to in terms of problem-solving skills and our modern culture? Because this is a different era.
Right. Well, in that study. But it's that our learning style is we don't want to have to solve the same problem over and over again. Once it's solved, people move on. Like, you don't want to have to reinvent the wheel every day. And so if someone solves it incorrectly, it just gets passed on and on and on. Nobody stops to go back and see what the actual problem is. An example that was given to me was a newlywed couple. The woman serving meatloaf and cuts the ends off and, you know, when she serves it on the plate. And the husband says, well, why'd you cut the ends off? Well, I don't know. That's the way my mom always fixed it. Well, so they go ask, you know, mom, you know, what... Why'd you cut the ends off? Well, I don't know. That's the way your grandmother always fixed it. And they go ask grandma. And she says, well, I don't know. That's the way my grandmother always fixed it. Nobody knew why. They just were doing it because that's the way it was done.
Hmm.
They don't solve the same problem over again. And the more efficient you want to seem to be, you just grab whatever somebody else's answer is and run with it instead of thinking out the problem.
And you corresponded their location with the temperature taken from a thermal image that was...
Well, the temperature wasn't taken from a thermal image. There was an image that's supposed to collect frequencies of light or something that by a NASA a flyover image.
Mm-hmm.
And that was given to JPL, the Jet Propulsion Lab, that cranked numbers through, and then given to USGS, U.S. Geological Survey, to make a map out of it. So it went through three different hands, and it was assumed that this was a temperature that it represented. Now, we have somebody wading through water that's not boiling, and it says it's, what, 819 degrees, was it?
Around that.
Fahrenheit. and you know, water boils at 212.
Right.
And this water isn't boiling. We have firefighters wading through it.
Right, and you said it would look like a steam explosion.
Well, you'd have a steam explosion if it was that hot. Because water, when it becomes steam, expands in volume by 1,600 times.
So,
that's why you have steam explosions. It's like all the atoms need more room.
So you have a real issue with the temperature component here. I think that's a real cognitive blind spot for many people. And you mentioned that they couldn't have
Also, if you just want to look at the dogs, remember all the search dogs that
right.
they're having to look down every nook and cranny? Those dogs' feet weren't burning up. The fur wasn't on fire.
Now, Dr. Wood, you mentioned that they couldn't have gotten away with this back in the 1970s and maybe the 80s. Can you tell listeners why?
People still weren't digesting everything they saw on TV and believing it. Also, they had more critical thinking skills. They would stop to think about things. And even if it came out in the newspaper, reading something in your hands in paper form, you think about it in more depth. And you're likely to put a flag on the play. You know, you're likely to say if something did not make sense. You know, if you have these oxy-fuel hoses draped across the debris field. Well, that debris field can't be hot if you're draping oxygen hoses across on the ground. You know, with these big oxygen tanks for welding and so forth and cutting torches. And that somebody would have seen and would have recognized that doesn't make sense. But when you have mass media that people are used to and the internet people are used to, they tend to go with the flow because they're not going to resolve a problem that somebody else has solved. And they assume that the grown-ups have it all figured out.
When you say used to, it's really trust. They trust that they're going to be told the truth.
By whomever they put their belief in, whether it's someone telling them an aluminum is silver at all temperatures, and they shut off their mind, or they think that the debris field is 2,000 degrees? It would be glowing if it was that temperature. When you turn out the lights at night, you know, there's no more sunlight. You have spotlights and so forth, but you'd have big, bright spots, blinding light. Think of a blast furnace, how bright light that is. If the ground is that hot, people are going to see it.
As you point out, the evidence always tells the truth. We talked about the alternative media in past shows. They're not held accountable as much as even the mainstream media that you had pointed that out, and I thought that was interesting. Can you tell listeners a little more about that?
Yes. If we had journalistic integrity in the alternative media, there wouldn't be a cover-up. Network media is what I call it. They have accountability. They don't have to talk about something, but if they talk about something and someone can determine whether it's true or false, there's nothing to back it up, they can be sued. You know, think about, why is Dan Rather out of a job? Why did he get chased out? Somebody gave him some bogus data. It wasn't his story. He was just reading the story. But it was bogus data, and he got hung for it. There's, you know, numerous other cases. There's even cases where somebody wrote a fake story in the New York Times, and, you know, that was really egg on their face because that got out. Of course, the guy was fired and then some. But in the alternative community, if somebody is dishonest, there's not much to sue. You know, shallow pockets as opposed to deep pockets. And there's no accountability. And it ends up being just sort of mass rumor mill like high school, you know, making fun of somebody and getting a rumor mill going and getting sort of like gang mentality where facts and truth are not, in there. It's not a priority.
Dr. Wood, you mentioned a really good 2008 article in The Atlantic titled, "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" And this relates to what we're talking about in terms of how are people getting away with lying? How are we able to be tricked? this isn't necessarily a cop-out, but it's interesting to point out. There are many good things about this article, but I want to look at this first. And it reads, "The idea that our minds should operate as high-speed data processing machines is not only built into the workings of the Internet, it is the network's reigning business model as well. The faster we surf across the web, the more links we click and pages we view, the more opportunities Google and other companies gain to collect information about us and feed us advertisements. Most of the proprietors of the commercial Internet have a financial stake in collecting the crumbs of data we leave behind as we flit from link to link. The more crumbs, the better. The last thing these companies want is to encourage leisurely reading or slow, concentrated thought. It's in their economic interest to drive us to distraction."
It's just like being hit with a whole bunch of billboards and a whole bunch of stuff during the breaks between the show on TV. And it just you're just bombarded with stuff. But there's a particular a quote from that article that I absolutely love. Well, one liner says, "Once I was a scuba diver in the sea of words. Now I zip along the surface like a guy on a jet ski." In order to fly along, you don't have time to stop and evaluate if something is true or not. You just take it at face value, swallow it, and go to the next thing.
One thing I liked about this article is it does say that our brains continue to form and reform thoughts and ideas and concepts and paradigms, and it references a plasticity of our brains into adulthood. It's not fully formed when we're adults, and we have the plasticity as of a child's brain still in adulthood, meaning we could change the way we think. There are physiological opportunities to do that.
Right, but it also means we can easily become lazy and turn our thinking over to someone else's keeping. But we can take it back, is what you're pointing out.
We can take that back, and that's the important message here in this interview is we do have recourse. Even though our problem-solving skills and critical thinking abilities have been atrophied a little bit, we can take that back.
Exactly. And my book is many people have commented, it's a course in critical thinking. It helps deprogram people and have them learn, you know, what are you seeing right in front of you? No, don't assume what you think you're supposed to see. What do you actually see right in front of you? Okay, the next thing, you know, being able to notice what is really there instead of a knee-jerk response of what you think is supposed to be there. And, you know, back in 1970, there was a lot more of that. So if someone showed towers turning into dust in midair on the TV set, there'd be a lot more people that would say, wait a minute, that isn't what a collapse looks like. But in 2001, there's little questioning. Say, oh, that must be what a collapse looks like.
Now, Dr. Wood, one thing that you mentioned I thought was interesting as well was you called this destructive mechanism like the field effects from a weaponized tornado. What did you mean by that?
Well, I didn't necessarily, put it in those terms directly off the bat, but I put things in perspective of what people themselves are familiar with. People haven't seen this square peg that they're trying to fit in the round hole, so they assume it doesn't exist. But they really do know that it exists. They're aware of tornadoes. And out of how many years have we known about tornadoes? Don't you think someone has weaponized it in a lab somewhere? Learned what really controls tornadoes and can weaponize it. So if you think of what happened in 9/11 as a weaponized tornado, then it's easy to understand because that's a familiar thing. You don't even know what the serial number of the parts is or what the operator had for breakfast. But you know that tornadoes destroy things. Where does the energy come from? You don't know that. You think of, several mile long, thing a half mile wide, a big path that a tornado destroyed in Topeka, Kansas. Where'd that energy come from? Do you have to make the calculations first to determine whether or not all that material was destroyed? Building completely gone, nothing left, except a few shreds of something? You know that it exists because you observed what happened there. There was a building there. It's no longer there. There's just a few fragments left. There might be a doll sitting there and nothing else left. Something just, you know, bizarre. Or half the building's there, intact, and the other half is completely missing. You know that that happens because you've witnessed it. Just imagine if someone figured out how to make a tornado in the lab and weaponize it. That would be a lot easier to understand.
Yes, and the field effects are really interesting because you had mentioned it's not necessarily wind we're talking about here.
Right. We see pictures like from a couple years ago in near Dallas-Fort Worth area. There's a picture of a house missing the roof. Their big widescreen TV, flat-screen TV, was still intact. There is some books on the bookshelf and a stack of printer paper. Nothing dislodged, nothing blown around. How do you have the roof missing and none of the loose papers disturbed?
And I like the musical chairs analogy that you use. The music's playing and then it stops.
Right. Yeah, you see a piece of straw stuck through a tree or something else. Think of, while the music's playing, the atoms are up dancing around like a game of musical chairs. When the music stops, they have to sit down. But there's not quite enough chairs left, and some get left hanging out there. And if you think of it, of the effect of that, you know, like people just up walking around for musical chairs, the atoms actually seem to, it seems to be a good analogy for what is happening.
Does that connect to the more accurate term that you use, magnetic electrogravitic nuclear reactions?
Well, I'm using that term. Again, I don't like to do name dropping. That is just the evidence that this thing produces. You have magnetism, electricity, gravity affected, and nuclear reactions.
Now, nuclear reactions doesn't imply a thermal.
Well, it just means a nuclear reaction. It doesn't mean a high heat necessarily. Could be low heat. But it means something is affected on the nuclear level. If you have effects of transmutation that you, as one of the pieces of evidence, something has caused the atomic nature to change in that material.
Oh, go ahead.
And it could get heat from it, or it could take heat from the environment. But, you know, heat will change.
Dr. Wood, the issue of temperature comes up many times in your book, Where Did the Towers Go? For example, the so-called fires with unburnt paper near them, the so-called molten metal in the street, welding hoses laying over debris reported to be at temperatures that would melt metal, the grappler picking up what appears to be glowing metal. If the metal was glowing hot, those hydraulics wouldn't function normally. Reports of steel-toed boots, of cleanup crews melting, what appears to be a puddle of water deep in a hole near Liberty Street, the lack of steam, fumes instead of smoke, fumes instead of steam explosions. This area is interesting because it just keeps coming up again and again, yet a lot of people didn't catch it, but you've used your observation powers to analyze this information and put it forward. Why is this important?
Well, it's important because it's important for people to identify evidence themselves through their eyes, not what they're being told, but what they see. For example, the Bible-related artifact that's at the 9/11 Museum, when the Pope came to visit, he went and visited this artifact because it was said to have been fused into metals. It had molten metal running over the pages of this Bible artifact, yet the pages weren't burned. And do people stop to, and pause and say, wait a minute, if the pages aren't burned, how can this be hot molten metal that was, now re-solidified, rolling over the pages? It could be liquid, but that doesn't mean it's hot. And so that piece of evidence is striking that you have resolidified metal that was rolling over a page, and the page is not at all burnt, or it doesn't have any evidence of heat damage. But how many people do you know of who just assume it was hot?
A lot of people, and among them are physicists who would know better, you would think.
Right, and this comes from not observing, but just kind of like a knee-jerk flashcard type of response. If it's glowing, it must be hot. If it was previously liquid, it must have been hot. Rather than realizing it was liquid, but for a different reason other than being hot. And that's a difficult one to say, but you have to look at the evidence to see that. There's no way that somebody could argue that it was hot molten metal pouring over a Bible, you know, open Bible through the pages, and not at all burn the pages.
And the so-called fires in the street, the observable data there, visually, it is very intriguing. Another critical area to rethink what you're looking at, because the paper isn't burned next to these so-called fires.
And then just see, what do you see? Something is bright, glowing, but then the material around it isn't burning. And if it's metal and it's glowing because it's hot, it's like, over 1,200 degrees centigrade. And that's pretty hot. And if it's liquid metal and it's glowing because it's hot, and if it's iron, it's got to be 1,535 degrees centigrade to be liquid. And certainly paper would have burned long before then. So, it's got to be glowing for a different reason other than heat. Rather than people kind of memorize, if it's glowing, it must be hot. And the everyday example I give in refutation of that is that, or to show that isn't always the case, is a fluorescent light bulb versus an incandescent light bulb.
Yes, and the difference is there's a gas in one of them.
Yeah, it's a type of plasma that's in there. It's like the fluorescent light is illuminating for a different reason than the incandescent bulb. The incandescent bulb is like a resistance wire that's, so hot that it's glowing. But that isn't why the fluorescent light glows. It glows for a different reason.
It strikes me that the flames that you see...
The apparent flames.
The apparent flames that you see burning in the street, you would assume that they're consuming oxygen as a normal fire would. I have never seen plasma flames look like that and not be hot.
You've seen plasma globes, children's physics toys, and it looks just like them, but it's not hot. You can put your hand around them, and the bright light that looks like a flame in those plasma globes, it follows to your finger.
But those are
but it's not hot.
Those are in enclosed bulbs, and
yep,
and they're in an enclosed bulb for a reason. These are out in the open air.
Right, they're in an enclosed bulb which has a certain environmental condition. What happens if that environmental condition is out in the open?
And we're talking about a field effect here.
Yes.
The field effect on that day, September 11, 2001. Here in New York City, you had that hurricane off the coast. And could you describe how a field effect would be created with the mechanics of a hurricane?
Well, we know with hurricanes that, when a hurricane's coming, birds leave town. They sense the hurricane coming. There's an electrical type field effect in front of the hurricane. And some people with... arthritis often complain, that they feel a storm coming. They can feel it because there's a different electrical environment. After the storm leaves, there's another electrical environment that people feel. And there's a lot of studies that have been done about sitting next to a waterfall. I think you had commented that you don't get fistfights going on next to a waterfall.
Arguments.
They're very calming and relaxing. And many waiting rooms, like doctor's offices, dentist's offices, will have a fountain in there, and it keeps people, you know, peaceful while they're waiting. They don't get so antsy. So there's a different kind of atmosphere that's created from that. It's a field effect. Another example of field effect, of course, is your cell phone. You know, there's a certain range that the cell phone tower reaches. That's a field. And if you have your cell phone, a working cell phone, within that field and it can connect to the tower, then you can talk to somebody. And so, you know, let's think about what a hurricane is.
Okay.
You got this big disc swirling around the sky. You know, it's moist air moving around. Well, think of walking across the floor in your socks, and you reach out and touch a doorknob, and it arcs. You get a zap. So you've built up a different charge relative to the door handle. Or you rub a balloon on your sweater, and it sticks to it. There's various things through rubbing that build up an electrical charge through friction. And a Van de Graaff generator is that type of charge also. It creates a static field. So you look at a hurricane, and it looks very much like a big Tesla coil, which also makes a static field. It seems quite likely that you're going to have this big static field surrounding, you know, in front of the hurricane and to the sides of. And that could be likely what birds sense when they run to go hide or leave town. And they know a hurricane's coming because that's how they would know.
And that field is on the outside, of course, of the hurricane. Who knows how far in advance in around it?
We know it was close enough to Manhattan on 9/11 because at all three of the major airports, JFK, Newark, and LaGuardia, all three airports recorded thunder that day. And thunder is an electrical arcing, you know, a connection between things. So you're getting an electrical, you know, spark, so to speak, from something. And then you have this big, you know, mega-sized Tesla coil out there right off the end of Long Island. You know, it knows a hurricane. So we do know that it was there in creating that environment.
Creating a field effect.
Yeah, whether or not it was deliberately put there for that reason, we can't say.
Do we know that it was used for the destructive mechanism?
No, because we're not in the planning department for the destruction, what caused the destruction that day. But what we do know through parallel evidence is that, you know, John Hutchison's work, he uses a Tesla coil. I think he later used a Van de Graaff generator to create a static field. And then within that static field, he would interfere radio frequency signals, typically microwave signals, in that static field, and got these weird effects. There's something about the combination, the interference of these different fields that would produce this weird effect, where he would get lift or disruption. Lift meaning something floated up, and disruption meaning it was toasted, as I call it. The material got disrupted.
That's really important parallel evidence.
Like there's one fellow, a photographer, standing at the base of Tower 2, and he's going to take a picture of what's happening. He puts his camera up, and he sees the building coming apart, and decides he better make a run for it. And he says, as soon as he got to the corner of West and Liberty, he was picked up like being picked up by a tornado and was carried, you know, a full block.
Right, and the person in the stairwell who seemed to have floated down?
Right. These firefighters who were trapped in stairwell B during the destruction of the North Tower, they were talking. Like one fellow said he was on the sixth floor, and then he was thrown down to the first floor. Well, this is a stairwell where you go down a half a flight, and then you turn and get down another half flight and turn. So you go boomity 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 round. He wasn't damaged. He didn't hit anything. So being thrown down the stairs, it was more likely he was lifted down the stairs. And there was another guy who actually said that he was lifted. He had to reach up and pull his hat down because it was floating off him.
Have you looked into what's going on the atomic level when a microwave is going through a controlled field, such as John Hutchinson's experiments, and you get those weird effects?
I'm looking at observable evidence, cause and effect. You see, something happened, and something happened as a result of it, and it's repeatable. And if he creates a static field, and when he interferes a radio frequency through that static field, he gets these weird effects. And it's, you know, very reproducible. But it's got to be a particular type of wave and, you know, shape of wave and, you know, the interference type. And depending on the mix, you could get something totally different, like lift or disruption or something in between. That's why in some areas you get lift and some areas you get disruption. But you usually don't get both at the same place at the same time. Like we saw a car that was parked, you know, on the side of the road, and it was toasted. The car parked in front of it looked like in pristine condition, except it was upside down. You know, the wheel sticking up in the air. And so it was obviously lifted, but wasn't toasted. The one that wasn't lifted was toasted.
Two very different effects from possibly the same phenomena, but very close to each other. That's interesting.
Yes. Instead of studying some theoretical model, I prefer to look at evidence because you can learn so much from observing the world around you. And that's something that is less and less encouraged in our culture. It's more of this memorize and regurgitate without even understanding what you're memorizing and how it applies to anything. Instead, you know, try to reach into own personal experiences. For example, have you ever been to a waterfall? Or after a nice rain, if the air feels any better? Is it cleaner feeling? Does it make you feel, you know, warm, fuzzy feeling inside? If a rainstorm is approaching, of course, you're busy running for cover, but is there a different feeling? And noticing those kinds of things, those are real phenomena.
You mentioned the discovery of static electricity and then the long downtime before electricity was discovered.
No, I don't know if it was really that long or if it just got undiscovered. But according to our history books, see, I wasn't around that many years ago, but according to our history books, static electricity was discovered in the year 600 BC. Yet, according to our history books, it took another 2,400 years to discover electricity. Does that make sense? In 600 BC, static electricity. And then 2,400 years after that, they discover electricity. Were there no thunderstorms in between those two points in time? Of course there are thunderstorms. Were people discouraged from thinking independently? Or did they actually understand it, but then the next generation unlearned it? We just threw it away, and then the following generation never knew it was even discovered. We don't know, but one thing we do know is observations would have fixed it. And there's another thing that people are discouraged from observing. It might take another 3,000 years till it comes to the forefront and in popular life, and that's tornadoes. We're talking about, you know, creating a static field and within it interfering radio frequency signals, as John Hutchinson does. We know what the effect is. It's been repeated over and over again. If that is indeed true, which we know it is, knowing that, let's see how that applies to other things. Let's, for a minute, think about in the Midwest. We normally have tornadoes. It's called Tornado Alley for a reason. In late spring and into the summer, you get a lot of tornadoes moving through there. That's normal. But in the past several years, since about 2008, we've had these mega tornadoes, like Joplin, Missouri, where you see humongous tornadoes. All of a sudden, and like a step function. What happened then? Well, this is just, you know, coincidence, maybe, maybe not, that in February 2009 was the deadline for requiring people to move over to digital television. So guess what was happening in the summer of 2008? A lot of brand new radio frequency transmission towers were built. And now comes the spring, and you have, nice static field moving through because you have normal storm systems, but you have also now new radio frequency transmission towers. This could be an unintended consequence, but it is indeed something, you know, we know through John Hutchison's work that you interfere radio frequency signals in a static field and bad things happen, or good things, you know, things happen.
Yes.
And there was that incident where, I think it was New Year's Eve, where some birds fell out of the sky.
There were many in the past. You don't hear about it as much, but yeah, for many,
well,
many years.
Well, this particular one that happens, a big flock of birds, they just kind of dropped out of the sky and died on the ground. Now, as they're flying, literally, they just fell out of the sky. And I immediately looked at the weather maps there, and there was a storm system that had just, this is the tail end of the storm system that was just moving through that area. And this was a place between two towns that undoubtedly had nice transmission towers there. This wasn't out in the boondocks. And so you also think, but just think about the consequences of this. We don't need to prove one way or the other of that event, but that's one thing to think about, why we've not had this type of event before, a sudden, you know, birds falling out of the sky and dying. But think of all the cell phone towers that have been put in. Think of all of the wireless internet signals that are out there. All of these wireless transmissions of various radio frequency signals. And then you have a static field from a normal storm system. You're fixing a mess up. It's a disaster waiting to happen. You'll have the right place and time, the right relative magnitude of the signals, and you're going to have a problem. And I tend to think that might be why we're having these mega tornadoes.
Slightly related, speaking with a woman who lives in Western Canada, and she lives along a coast where big ships come in. She said to me that at night when the ships come in, she could feel them in terms of the microwave transmissions on the tops of the ships. It will wake her up.
I've heard of other people who've had to move from areas along the coast without realizing why. It's just, they're just driven nuts. They're very sensitive to these signals and had to go elsewhere. They think that somebody's out after them, but I think it's more of an unintended consequence of, you know, what man has created without watching what they're doing and understanding what they're doing. You know, in Joplin, Missouri, when this tornado was coming, there's a bunch of people that ran into a convenience store, and they didn't know where to hide, so they went in the walk-in freezer, closed themselves in there. And the tornado went right through there, right outside the store and over the store. And when they're in this group of people were in this cooler, somebody left their video camera going, and the camera's spinning around, and there you see some bright flashes here and there. Keep in mind, this is a closed container they're in. And then when it all stopped, you're, hey, Sam, are you on top of me? Who's below me? In other words, these guys had been floating around in there, and they settled down. They're all stacked up. That's not wind.
Thanks for
adding
that.
That's anti-gravity. In a tornado.
Well, Dr. Wood, I really appreciate you being on the show talking about this. What are you doing now? What can you tell listeners what you have planned this year? Are you working on another book or another project?
Yes, I haven't figured out if people are ready for it yet, though, because they actually seem like they're less ready for it. But it shouldn't be about how can you debunk someone, but what problem are you trying to solve? What do you want to know? In order to solve a problem, you have to define the problem that you're solving and define what you're looking for in that solution. Instead of this new mentality that gets going on the internet of seeing who you can debunk. You can debunk anything by lying about it, so what does that get you? It doesn't solve anything. So figure out first what problem are you trying to solve. But the most important thing is how to problem solve. Know what it is that you know that you know that you know, and know that everything else you don't know. And don't fill in that gap of unknowns with speculation and guesswork and theories and whatnot, because then you don't know anything to do with what you have. Everything's just a mess. If you're clear of what you do know, your conclusion, if it's enough to be conclusive, then you'll know that answer, like the scientific method, as Professor Eric Larson stated. That conclusion will be irrefutable.
It's such a great quote from Professor Eric Larson. Dr. Wood, author of the book, Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. Dr. Wood is a former professor of mechanical engineering. She's a forensics engineer, essentially. She has research interests in experimental stress analysis, structural mechanics, optical methods, deformation analysis, and the materials characterization of biomaterials and composite materials. Dr. Wood, thank you again for being on Another News.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Thanks for tuning in.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have the chance, let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune, and then there may be teardrops to share. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance, dance. Let's face the music and dance.